I would like to let you know the problem that I'm dealing with. A keynote speaker, we have a few jobs. Our jobs are to give some major ideas that can be discussed throughout the day. Our jobs are to get you awake in the morning, in many cases. Our jobs are sometimes to provoke you. Rarely do we get nuance and subtlety in the time allotted to us. So, I'm pretty good at that. The reason there's a collar up there is that many of my colleagues and friends have taken to calling me a preacher. I get a call that says, how is the good minister doing today? That may not mean the same thing in Belgium as it does in America, because we have a tradition of the Baptist preacher. People who are fiery, we sweat, I will sweat, we yell, we usually have snakes involved at some point. It's a very interesting culture. So the problem is that I like that. I do get emotional, I do get excited. But I was talking with my wife last night at dinner, and I said, sometimes it's hard to do that. Sometimes it's hard to come before a group that is in trouble, that is in crisis, that has had hard times. How do I go before a group of librarians in a time when many feel threatened? Many feel their jobs threatened. Many feel the entire profession threatened. Many people worry about public libraries and school libraries. And this is, by the way, not just in Belgium. This is in the United States. This is in Italy. This is in the UK. It seems everywhere I go, people say, David, come, we need you. And I say, why? We want to be inspired. I gave several workshops while I was here this week, and I asked, what do you want out of the workshop? And the by and large answer was, I want to be inspired. I want dreams. And as my wife and I were having dinner last night, I said, how do you go before a group that is rightfully anxious and inspire them? How do you look into their eyes and say, it's going to be okay, when you know it may not be? My wife asked, what do they mean by inspire? And I said, well, in talking with some, often it means that they want to find again why they got into this profession, that they became a librarian, in many cases, because they wanted to do something. They wanted to make a difference. They wanted to bask in knowledge. They wanted to reach out and help people. They wanted to be of service. They wanted to change the world. And when they met the world, it had different ideas. Many people feel like they want to find that thing that's going to keep them going, that's going to keep them doing what they're doing, that they can once again take courage, they once again can take confidence, they once again can find word of solace. They want to refind their faith. Preacher. This is not also unusual in my duties, in that many times I feel like I'm either taking confessions or helping people find the faith again. And I said, I don't know what to say tomorrow. Bruno will be happy to know my keynote slides were put together last night. I said, I don't know what to say. And she looked at me and she said, David, you know something about challenges of faith. You know something about facing hopelessness. Start there. So I want to show you some pictures today. And this is the first one. The picture, I think I have a laser even, that one, that's me about a month after I came to Amsterdam about 4 or 5 years ago. That's me 2 years ago. And that's not a bad fashion choice, by the way. That's a situation where while I was smiling for that picture, what I did not realize is growing throughout my chest was Hodgkin's lymphoma. I had blood cancer. Now, Hodgkin's lymphoma is not a bad cancer to get, they say. 90% cure rate. Not hold back, not chronic, cure. 90% through chemotherapy. And so that picture is after 6 months of chemotherapy. That picture is after I lost what little hair I had left, what God didn't take. I lost my eyebrows. That was tough. That's after chemotherapy that was considered mild, and yet I had to have my 14-year-old son help me walk up the stairs. But after the chemotherapy, it looked good. And then they did another scan, and they said, well, we didn't get it. We have to move to salvage treatment. So for the mathematicians in the audience, a 90% cure rate becomes a 10% possibility that you don't want to be in. And they said, there's one thing that we can do. What we can do is that we can put you in such intense chemotherapy that not only will it kill the cancer, it will kill the bone marrow in your body that makes your blood cells. It will be a lethal dose of chemotherapy. But it's okay. We will take some of that bone marrow before we start. We will freeze it and we'll give it back to you. And it'll grow back. Maybe. How does one look at the idea of taking a lethal dose of chemotherapy and remain optimistic? How does one do this? I went into the hospital and they had a surgeon place a catheter that went through my neck and into my heart. So that on the day of the transplant, when they brought in, the doctor sat and began injecting large syringes of stem cells directly into my heart. And I shivered and I got cold. And my wife held my hand. And the nurse came up to me and started talking to me and she said, tell me about where you most like to go. In your mind, get a picture of where you want to be. Don't lose hope. Have the picture of where you're going to be. And that picture was this. It's a beach in Maine in the United States. And it's not a beach very unlike what we have right outside. So as they were pumping these stem cells through my heart, as the question became, would I live, would it grow, would I make it, in my mind, I had a picture of why I wanted to live, of what it could be, of how we could do it. I'm going to talk to you today about pictures. I'm going to talk to you today about hope and faith. And some people in this profession, some people in all professions, will say hope and faith have no place. This is not about hope and faith. This is about action. And you are right. But action begins with knowing or believing that you can succeed, that we can find that faith again, that we can recreate that librarianship that drew you into the profession. And so I want to talk to you about this picture. Not a very interesting picture. Well, it is interesting, but it's puppets. What does this have to do with it? We'll get there. To start telling you the story of this picture, I need to show you some other ones. And I hope you'll make a connection. Here's the first one, and it looks very familiar. December 2007. The United States banking and finance industry, due to extensive deregulation, due to extensive speculation, due to lax rules where they would loan money in the real estate market primarily to anyone and then hide the risk in derivative funds and sell them across the globe, the deal finally came to an end. And the loan industry and the insurance industry and the stock industry and the banking industry exploded. We closed larger, too big to fail, and the economy tanked. And you're welcome, we took the entire global economy with us. Right? And so we get this. What happened? People lost their jobs. People didn't just lose their jobs, they lost faith. Now, if they had faith, they were still losing their jobs. I'm not in my own reality. I understand that. But we saw again and again that suddenly people were out of work. People were unemployed. The economic crisis had occurred. People lost their houses. Some people couldn't get rid of their houses because they now owed more money than the house was worth. We saw this in income taxes. We saw this everywhere. And you know what happened? Librarians lost their jobs. Some of them did. It turns out what happens in most economic downturns, which is good for a university professor, they go back to school. When you say, I've lost your job, what am I going to do now? Go back to school. Go back to school. Be retrained. Clearly, education will get us out of this. And so we actually hired more academic librarians because we had more students acquiring more debt as they came in. And there's a very interesting thing in the United States, but in most municipalities, the taxes are usually acquired 1 to 2 years before the current financial year. So there was actually this 2-year period where we saw what was about to happen with local governments, with city librarians, with state librarians, with government librarians, but it came and we saw layoffs. We saw librarians without jobs. We saw reduced hours. We saw closed branches. There wasn't enough money to go around. At the same time, more pictures. Not everyone felt the sting in the same way. This is a graph that shows you in the United States about U.S. wealth. This line, this dark blue line, is the 90% of households in the United States. So 90% of the U.S. households hold approximately 20% of the total wealth of the nation. This light blue line is the 0.1%. 0.1% of people in the United States have also 20% of the wealth of our nation. The largest economic income disparity since before the Great Depression, before the Great Gatsby, before the Gilded Age. The rich were not feeling the pain in the same way that everyone on the street was, that the worker was, that the librarian was, that the student was. In the midst of an economic downturn, they actually prospered. Another picture. As I said before, it just didn't happen in the United States. It happened all over the world. What this meant was that there were fewer opportunities all around the United States, on our southern border and on our northern border. We found suddenly that people without options were turning to crime, were turning to drugs, were turning to different things throughout the North American, South American, Central America. And what did they do? They did whatever they could to leave a situation of poverty, to leave a situation of conflict, to leave a situation of struggle. It was so bad that in Central America, parents, loving, dedicated parents, were so afraid for their children, where gangs of drug dealers would come into schools and recruit their children directly in their classrooms, that these parents sent their children to go to North America, to go into America, even if there's an option. This graph that you're looking at, this picture, shows that from 2009 to 2014, the number of unaccompanied child migrants, the number of children without parents that were illegally attempting to get into the United States, that's how bad it was. Another picture. We lost money. We didn't have enough for our local taxes. In the United States, local taxes pay for our schools. It has an impact. This graph, this picture you're looking at, shows the number of countries and their educational achievement. In other words, how much of what percentage of the population gets at least a high school degree? You'll see, for example, in Korea, the age 45, the generation 45 to 54, think of them as the parents, they only had about 58% of folks who got a high school education. Their children are nearly now at 100%. As education became more available, wider spread, more supported, more students went, their children had more education and better opportunities. You'll notice something about this graph. In every one of the countries, the green line, the children, the new generation, is higher than the previous generation. In every country, from Mexico to Turkey to New Zealand to Finland to the Czech Republic to Belgium, their children could achieve more in school than their parents, except one. For the first time in the United States, we anticipated that children would actually achieve less education than their parents. I could show you this graph, by the way, for economic opportunity. I could show you this graph for moving through different class statuses. What's the impact of something like this? I think it looks a little bit like this, which is, hopefully, here we go. This is a question that was asked that said, Gallup poll, thinking about what is it said in the news, in your view, is the seriousness of global warming generally exaggerated? Look what happens. 2004 goes down, we believe that global warming exists, and then what starts to happen? More and more people question the reality of climate change. More and more people question whether man made climate change. More and more people wonder if all of this is just hype. Do we need to cap carbon? Do we need to worry about the ice sheets? Do we need to worry about sea levels rising? This one, I have to admit, I got so angry and so depressed last night putting these slides together, I had to do something. So while this slide is about the fact that government began to reduce services, they began to reduce food services, literacy services, they began to reduce after-school programs, they began to reduce jobless training, they began to reduce support for retraining, they began to reduce everything that went into local government that was the safety net of our society. Once again, not a happy topic, but I want to let you know the how bad it got. This picture is from 2 weeks ago. This is the state of Illinois. The state of Illinois does not have a budget. And by refusing to get a budget, they've had to cut services. So if you get a driver's license in the United States, you go to our Department of Motor Vehicles and you give them money. That money is collected by armored cars and brought to the state capitol. They have not paid that bill, so the armored cars will no longer deliver. This poor man won the lottery. I mean, he won like millions of dollars in the lottery. And guess what he got from the state of Illinois? An IOU. He didn't get his money. They said, we'll pay you if we ever get a budget. Could you imagine winning the lottery and being told, that's nice, we'll get to you when we can. Really? You're wondering exactly where am I going with this, I'm sure. Another picture to show you, and I promise it gets better. This is a picture where we can say, what do we have? What I've talked about is an economic crisis and the need to transform our economy. We're talking about mass human migration and the need for diversity and cultural integration. All of these people coming across the border, do they learn English? Do they learn our history? Do they learn about the Constitution? Who trains them? Who prepares them? Who helps them? Attacks on rationalism in public policy and a need for scientific literacy. Do we vote because we have science that tells us something, or do we vote because we have a donor or a campaign contributor that tells us something? The erosion of the liberal democratic participation into oligarchies and the false belief that simply voting means that we have representation. That when you could not reach out to your government and talk to your representative and be at the meeting and see the notes, that that was increasingly being degraded by the economic situation and a quest where we have right now. In the United States, people running for president who are billionaires, who are completely unaccountable to the people who vote for them. Now, Now, that's one thing, but at least I can respect the fact that they're billionaires. What we also have are people running for president who are sponsored by billionaires. When I give you $1 billion to run for office and you get elected, whose voice exactly are you going to listen to when it comes time to make decisions? Now, what's interesting about this picture is it's from last Tuesday when I presented a keynote in Tilburg. And I wasn't talking about the United States. Right? We have a little familiarity with the idea of human migration. Might be something we're talking about right now. We have a little discussion about an economic crisis. Might be something we're talking about now. Talking about rationalism policy. Talking about the social safety net. These are issues that you are dealing with, that we are dealing with, that Italy is dealing with, that Greece is dealing with, that everyone, these days China is dealing with. These are hard issues. These are hard times. These are times when you sit there and go, I give up. These are times where you simply say, I can't deal with anything new. I have no hope. I have lost my faith. Regardless of whether you're a librarian or an accountant or a mortician or a gardener or a professor. But what happened? Let me show you some more pictures. What was the response by libraries in the United States, particularly public libraries, but libraries of all type? Because what happened in the United States, in the midst of all of this depression, in the midst of all of this loss of faith, in the midst of a huge need by our citizens, by the entire population, what happened? And what happened makes me so proud to be a librarian, I can't tell you. What happened was libraries said, these are problems that we can help. That rather than running and hiding, and rather than hoping and praying, and rather than waiting and seeing what we're doing, or saying, let's just reduce ourselves to the books and hope we don't get cut. What happened was the librarians looked out at their communities, their neighbors, their allies, the people living next to them, and what they saw were two things. The first, they saw people in pain. They saw people who were in trouble, people who needed help, people who had lost faith. And the second thing they saw were people, those people, coming at them, coming towards them and saying, we need help, we need help. We can't buy our books on Amazon. We don't even have enough money to pay for the internet connection anymore. We can't go figure out jobs when I want to apply for a job. If I'm a janitor and I lose my job, and you're in the United States and you're applying to work at a parcel delivery service, you have to apply online for that job. Even though as a janitor, no computer experience is required, nothing is necessary, but you can't get the job unless you can go online to apply for it. And not only once you go online do they just take your form, they watch how fast it takes you to fill in that form, and they judge your computer skills by how fast you fill in a form. And the janitors were coming into libraries and saying, I don't have a computer. Help me. And lawyers were coming into them and saying, I don't have clients, help me. And everyone was coming in and saying, help me, help me. And what happened? What happened is that the libraries of the United States said, we're going to help you. We're going to create things like community initiatives, where we talk about going out to communities and letting people know, leaving our buildings and being at the place of pain. Leaving our buildings to wait because we say, oh, we're going to help the new migrants. We're going to help new Americans. But they don't know to come to us yet, so we're going to go into their low-rent apartments. We're going to go into their housing. We're going to go into their neighborhoods and ask them, how can we help? What can we do? The Institute for Museum and Library Services, the closest thing we have to a ministry of culture, joined hands with our economic development arms at the federal level to create a whole system of libraries supporting job seeking and job helping. 30 million Americans used the library to help address career and employment needs in the last 12 months. This is in 2010. According to the estimates, the University of Washington study, 2010. Job seekers reported using the library to submit online applications, search for employment opportunities, update their resumes. This is data from the American Library Association from 2010. What were libraries doing? Loaning books? No. 88% of them were providing access to job databases and resources. 75% helped people practice for civil service. Others offered software resources to help create resumes, help them complete online job applications, offer classes in job seeking strategies. In one library, during the economic downturn, a librarian told the story that every day a man dressed like this would come into their library, sit at a table, open their briefcase, and look through the paper. But they were looking through the job ads every day. And she noticed that actually several people began doing that. Dressed up, tie, business, ready to go. And what did she do? Her response was she looked at a small staff area that was for drinks in the refrigerator. And she cleared out all the staff materials and she put in a coffee pot and she put the paper in and above it she put in professional resources. And soon, more people came in and they began using that room. And years later, so that what that man who dressed up came to that librarian and said, "Thank you." He said, "What you gave me was a sense of worth. What you gave me was the fact that I could be respected. What you gave me was beyond the databases and resources. You gave me a place to go where I felt included." But it didn't just stop there. Once people started coming in and looking for jobs, people realized this was not just a chance to find the next job. This was, for the worst circumstances ever, an opportunity to see what else you want to be. Do you want to go find another job, or is this time to go back to school? Is this time to find another job, or would you be better having one person stay at home with your children and one person working? Do you need direct assistance? Do you need food? Do you need access to pantry and civil services? Do you need access to education? And this library reached out and created a partnership with social services, with local universities, with local businesses, and so you could come to one place. And so if you said, "I want to go back to school," and someone said, "Well, you have to talk to the registrar or the bursar," whatever those are, there was a librarian, there was someone that could translate that into English to help them. And they began saying, "What else do we want to do? What else can we do for this community?" Because we're helping them language skills, we're helping them with job skills. Eventually, people came in and they said, "We need education." This is a picture from Cazenovia Public Library, which is in outside of Syracuse. And it's in a relatively rich village. But that village is in the poorest county of all of New York State, the poorest area of New York State. And they could stay in their library and they could serve out books. But what they did is they went to the local food pantry and they said, "We have children that come to the food pantry because their parents need food." And when those children are there, they have nothing to do. They have no opportunities. There's no one helping them to learn. And so they began getting literacy volunteers. They began getting teachers and librarians. And they set up a pop-up library in the food pantry. At one point, they brought free books. And they gave out free books to the people, to the children who would come. And Betsy Kennedy, who's the librarian, tells the story of giving a free book to a young girl. And the young girl began crying. She said, "What's wrong?" And the child said, "This is the first new thing I have ever owned." That book wasn't a distraction. That book wasn't a nice read. That book wasn't something to just take home. That book was worth. That book was humanity. That book was a connection. And when they gave out the books and the resources, and they said, why are these parents coming in? And many of them, because they didn't have the education to move forward. They didn't have a basic secondary education. So what did they do? The literacy volunteers worked with the kids, and they began high school courses in the food pantry. And when they ran out of room, because the county was wide, they began setting up little pop-up libraries in churches and food pantries across the entire county. They said, there's a problem, and we're librarians, and we solve problems, and we fix them, and we can be there to make it happen. And once we began to educate people, and once the recovery started happening slowly, and once we began to get the jobs in new communities and new places, libraries realized we could connect on a whole different level. What else do you need? How else do you want to learn? How else can we improve the society of which you are a part? And they found really remarkably interesting answers to that question. Excuse me. Meg Bacchus, a librarian who works at the North Onondaga Public Library, not a big library, sits at her desk. She was the public services librarian, which meant her job was to work with the public. She had several people who came in and they would ask her, could we do something? What could we do? Let's have a program. She had a bunch of knitters. Knitting? Yes? These knitters came into the library and they had a knitting club and they would do knitting. And it turns out in the United States, we have a National Knitting Day. Do you have one here in Belgium? Would you consider one here in Belgium? You should. So for National Knitting Day, her knitting group said, we want to go out to the public, expose people to the wonders of knitting. By the way, they started a needle exchange program, which had a totally different idea behind the needles. And so they said, let's go out. And it turns out that right around the corner is this big restaurant. It's called the Cracker Barrel. And the Cracker Barrel, I mean, if you have a stereotype of the Americans, that's this restaurant. It's Old West. It's, you know, folksy. It's got, like, really bad food that's deep fried and a lot of gravy, right? All right, I've had Belgian food. It's not completely different. But anyway, sorry. They said, they have a front porch. They have a front porch with rocking chairs. They said, let's go there. And so they called up, Meg Bacchus, hello.
Is this the Cracker Barrel?
Yes, it is.
I have a bunch of knitters who would like to come and use your front porch. Silence. Let me check with my manager. No.
They said no. They said, no, we don't want our front porch to be some sort of social action, like knitters. So what did the knitters do? I love this one. This one's a great story. The knitters said, let's go have a knit-in. Their way of protesting the idea was they went on National Knitting Day to Cracker Barrel, and they sat in the rocking chairs knitting and just begging them to call the cops. Because wouldn't that be the most wonderful news story ever? Cracker Barrel bust knitting ring. Well, these other folks came to Meg and they said, Meg, we want to learn how to garden. We love gardening. And they had books on gardening. They had, you know, here's a gardening book. But what Meg said is, some of these people are in apartments. Some of these people have no idea of gardening. Some of these people are going to read books and not get it. And she sort of literally looked out the window and said, we've got land. And for the price of a hose, they divvied up the land and they built the first library garden. The library garden is now, by the way, the library farm because it's gotten so large. And the community would come in and they would learn gardening together. They would garden together. In August, I don't know if this happens in Belgium, they would plant tomatoes. And in August, of course, 3,000 tomatoes would come out. Do you guys grow tomatoes here? No? Yes? Some? If you do you have friends? I'll tell you what, you know if you have friends who have grow tomatoes because they come into work with like these barrels going, please take a tomato. Oh God, get rid of these tomatoes, right? And so they began having discussions on local sourcing, local foods, food pantries, support. They started talking about the fact that in inner cities, they have what is called a food desert. That is, for many inner city residents, the closest food they have is packaged food from convenience stores and cheap food. They can't get fresh produce. They have now set up a farmer's market at the library to do this. Why? Because the community wanted to know, the community wanted to learn, and the trust that was forged when we helped during the economic crisis, the trust that was forged between the library and the community when they needed them, when they were there to respond, turned into what else could we do? This is a picture of Westport, Connecticut has a makerspace, right? We all have makerspaces because, you know, it's cool, right? We can 3D print things delightful. Not only do they have a makerspace that they have in Westport, Connecticut, they have incoming makers. They have makers in residency programs. They then said, it's not enough to just do it here. This is them in Russia teaching Russian librarians about makerspaces and 3D printings and community connections. They have an international outreach. I have watched it with great envy and great elation of things like the Library Avengers, things like the biking libraries, things like the mobile makerspace in a bus. You guys understand the idea of moving and connecting to a community, even when they're on two wheels, moving quickly. Your bicycle culture is amazing to me. I saw a couple biking down holding hands, and all I could think of was how cute and how my wife and I would be dead on the road running the bikes with it if we tried it. They connect to a community. The idea is they had this within the crisis. The crisis said, we have to do it. Then it turned into, we've done it. And then it turned into, what could we do next? And did it work? Well, one of the things we often talk about is when we try these new things, when we move beyond books, when we move beyond circulation, will our community go with us? It's amazing. I have heard some amazing, wonderful politicians. I have heard some amazing authors. I've heard some amazing professors come to library conferences and give a keynote. And there's always the same question that's asked. Thank you for your presentation. How do you see libraries fitting into your vision? There's an author who's talking about how he was a prisoner and that the library within the prison helped him find a new life to become a reporter. And his answer was pretty easy. Go to the prisons. Because when someone comes out of a prison, they better be part of a society with hope or else they're going to go right back in. Talk to someone in the intellectual freedom and anti-surveillance society. And the answer you often get back is, well, libraries are wonderful because if people read, they'll take on these issues. Libraries are great. We could really use more materials on this, right? So a rather closed view of what a library is. But what's amazing is if you push them a little further and go, well, what do you need within a community? And they'll say, oh, we need a place. We need a place that's trusted that people can gather. Huh. We need a place with people that can help with technology and understanding what they're doing with the surveillance society and government. Right? So when people buy their lovely little Apple Watch, there was just a story last month. Someone has written an app for your watch. So as you type, the micro movements of your body can be recorded and they can follow what you're doing on your keyboard through your watch. We need librarians to be able to say, that's a cool watch. Did you know? That's a great Kindle. Did you know? I see you have an iPad. Let's help you learn how to do the iPad. Did you know? And they don't connect the fact that this place of trust, of community, of combination, of connection, of linkages exists. And we have to be ready. So, did this work in the U.S.? Well, these are some pictures just released. We had this amazing, wonderful service in the United States called the Pew Center And the Pew Center is a foundation, and they do an amazing amount of polling. And they've been doing polling on public library perceptions and public library issues now for about a decade. This just came out this week. They asked the question, but I hit the wrong button. That's really interesting. We'll get back to you. There. Should libraries move some print books and stacks out of public locations to free up more space for things such as tech centers, reading rooms, meeting rooms, and cultural events? What was just 3 years ago, maybe, that didn't move much. What went from definitely not turned to 25% of definitely not, and yeses turned from 20 to 30%. Now, is that a huge epic shift? No, but in statistics, it's called significant. People are getting it. People are thinking from the same data. The public wants libraries to advance education, improve digital literacy, and serve key groups. Dark blue means definitely should do it. Light blue is, yeah, maybe. And yellow, gray, whatever that color is, no. Offer free literacy children to program. Easy, done. Coordinate more closely with local schools, providing resources for kids. Done. Offer programs to teach people, including kids, about digital tools. Yes. Offer programs to teach about protecting privacy and security. Yes. I have to tell you, our school library, they had us come in one day, and they had a police officer who worked specifically with 10-year-olds. And we happened to have a 10-year-old at the time. And you should have seen the number of scared parents in that room. We went in going, what's he going to talk about? The police officer gets up and says, when I talk to your 10-year-olds, the first thing I talk about is sexting. The first thing I do is say, you realize if you send naked pictures to your friends, they can come up again. And all the parents went. The next thing I talk about are these applications. Do you know about these? And he listed like 50 applications, of which Twitter and Facebook were not on the list. And we were all like, no. And he goes, well, they can be used to do this and this and this and pornography and rrrm. And by the end of it, we were like, what do we do? We paid money to bring the internet into our houses. We've set up our wireless networks. We have now made it available to our children to just go crazy, and we have no idea. And the library said, that's okay. We can help. Let's talk privacy. Let's talk settings. Let's talk education. Let's talk about making this work. Let's help you with an issue you didn't even know you had. Privacy, security, online. Did it work? This graph is a quick thing. Oops, we're getting that one. Did it work? I pressed too many times. I'm getting excited now. All right. World's most visited tourist attraction. There's the Louvre. 9 million, not bad. Great Wall got 10 million. They probably stacked the deck. Faneuil Hall got 18 million. Disneyland got 16 million. Niagara Falls, 22 million. The Massachusetts Public Libraries alone got 37 million visitors that year. One state, one place, one set of libraries. Did it work? Yes, it's worked. More people go to the New York Public Libraries than go to every opera, baseball game, basketball game combined. Did it work? Yes. Not only are they coming, not only are they there to help, do they want us to help, they want us to do new things and better things, and they want to be part of our success. It worked. So now I bring you to this picture. What is this picture? This picture is Rivka Sass of the Sacramento Public Library, and she is looking through her library of things. That puppet she's holding, looking at, is they circulate it. I'm guessing you guys do a lot of circulation of odd things as well. This comes from a New York Times piece, our paper of record, that talks about these public libraries are for snowshoes and ukuleles. There's a library that actually loans out a loom. Right? A loom. I just love saying that again. A loom. right? They loan out everything, fishing rods, all of this wonderful material. And this story, if it had come out even 6 years ago, even 5 years ago, would have had this nice little tinge of, and why are they doing that? What is a library? Why is that in a library? How dare they do that? But this whole piece centered on this statement. Libraries, arguably the original sharing economy, have long circulated art prints, music, and movies, and more recently have added tools. Those are all tools. But services like the Library of Things and the Stuffbrary in Mesa outside Phoenix are part of a broad cultural shift in which libraries increasingly view themselves as hands-on, creative hubs, places where people can learn new crafts, experiment with technology like 3D printers. So are there lessons that we can take? I'm not Flemish. You've already noticed. I don't pretend to tell you what you can, and many of these things you're already doing. I know. But here are some of the things that we learned that I hope have some use. First, you are not alone. You are part of the capital that libraries have accrued across the world. People love libraries. People love libraries in Belgium. People love libraries in the Netherlands. People love libraries in the United States. They love them. And we know we can begin to turn that, to capitalize on that, to support, to not just usage, but participation and being involved. And if you're having problems in your library, let's get together and talk about it. We have this brand that we can use. The other thing we learned is that libraries are in the storytelling business. Now that sounds so quaint as if to be painful. We tell stories. We must tell the stories of our communities. I was in Ghent yesterday in the wonderful Ghent Museum, the museum of the city, and they told the story from ancient times to current times, and they did it in partnership with the library. We can tell the story. In Ferguson, Missouri, well, let's go through these real quickly. We're here where you, when times are tough. We're here when violence erupts in inner city Ferguson. When violence erupts in inner city Baltimore, the libraries went in the middle of protests and riots and violence, and they opened their doors and they said, we are family. We are here to help you. We are going to feed you. We are going to bring the teachers in. We are a haven. We are here when times are tough. In the East Coast, as the hurricanes would wipe out cities and tear whole households into the oceans, the libraries opened so that people could power their cell phones, call their relatives, and tell them that they were alive. We are here when times are tough. In the times when you were laid off, we are here. In the times when you struggle with parenting, we are here. When you're struggling with drugs, we are here. When you struggle with homelessness, we are here. As the migrants flow over the borders. As families with three-year-old children risk their lives to escape bombing and violence and come to a new nation where they do not speak the language, where they are spit upon, where they are thrown into camps, we are here. We will go to those camps. We will bring you into our communities. We will help you with the language. You are a physicist. You are valuable. You are worthy. You are loved. We are here. We think ahead. We'll be here. Write your book. Do your great art piece. Create your video. We're here to make sure in 100 years and 200 years it's still available. Professors, write your pieces. Invent science. Develop whole new ways of understanding the universe. We will be here for you. We think ahead. We are ready for the dark ages because libraries brought us out of the dark ages. Libraries are arguably responsible for knowledge flowing into the city-states of Europe and bringing about a renaissance. We are here and we think ahead. And we will help you not simply consume and read and pacify. We will help you create. Create a book. Create a print. Create an art piece. Create a future. Create a vision. Create an aspiration. Create a goal. Create a marker of where we can be. Because we make things better. Libraries bring knowledge, and knowledge brings economic development, knowledge brings greater learning, knowledge brings self-actualization, knowledge brings people to what they can be, because librarians are not about fixing problems, they are about achieving dreams and aspirations. If you want inspiration, stop looking to me and go be the inspirations for your colleagues in your communities. You're the lights they need now. You're worried, you're scared. Absolutely. It's natural, it's right, it's human. But they're scared too. And they're hurting, and they need you. We build communities that we can trust us, and we will endure. We will move through this. Here are the crises that the U.S. faced. Here are the crises that you face. Be the change. Don't fight. Don't fall to cynicism. Don't look and think there is nothing before you. Don't look at the 10% on the survivability and assume that you're now on the wrong side of the survivability index. It's scary. It's scary, and you may even feel foolish standing before a crowd of your colleagues and saying there's a bright future as you watch your friends get laid off. But you can do it. Fight the calls for the absence of power. You are powerful. Your communities have invested you with power. Use it to rally the communities to support. Fight resignation, saying they're all out to get us, the government, the neoliberals, the whatever it is. Because they are us. If we are truly our communities, that incorporates politicians and lawyers and doctors and homeless and immigrant and librarian alike. And if we want the best for the community, we need to be a part of all of them. They are us. If you think that someone has the wrong view, vote them out. Follow them. Chase them. Talk to them. Engage them. Fight small thinking. How can you expect radical change, radical positive change, if you don't model it? You should be the inspiration of those around you. You should be the preachers. I know this is a secular world. I know that we have looked to move beyond the preacher and the deacon and the bishop and the cross as those that lead our communities. But we don't build cathedrals anymore. We build libraries. We build libraries and we fill them with librarians, and we build libraries and they may not be Gothic arches and flying buttresses, and it may not be marble and limestone, but through shafts of steel and glass, in book towers, in whole new areas, in pop-up libraries, in old industrial space brought back to life to bring in new startup and new ideas. Libraries are there, and libraries have the opportunities. You have communities, and they are in pain. You want to be inspired? You want to dream? You want to find what it is that brought you into this field? You want to see your power? Get out of your building. Go see them. Make someone learn. Help them achieve. Bring new ideas and opportunities about. Be your change. Thank you very much.